Our program is over lunchtime, as you well know, and for a lot of you, chances are there are sandwiches, soups, or maybe leftovers from last night's dinner getting eaten while you are listening in. And today, we are going to talk about how Americans, you and I, have come to regularly eat three meals a day. Talk about why we eat what we eat, with whom, where we eat it. Abigail Carroll is an author and a food historian. She taught in the gastronomy program at Boston University. She's published articles in a variety of publications, including New York Times, holds a PhD in American Studies from Boston University. And her book is titled Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. And she joins us today from the studios of the University of New Hampshire. Abby, welcome to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted.
Oh, I tell you what, it's great to have you come by. And it's, I tell you what, your book is really, I mean, there is so much interest these days in food.
Absolutely.
Not just to eat it, but I mean, just there's so much interest. It's great to have your book to read and to look at and to kind of know why we're eating what we're eating when we're eating it.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you, it's wonderful in that it starts out first before I even ask you questions about the book. How did you happen to come to write the book? I think that's an interesting story in and of itself.
Sure. Well, I've always been interested in history, and in particular food history, because I think food is just an amazingly fertile window into culture. But it's one that we just take for granted and we overlook, and yet it's just embodied with so many meanings. So anyways, I was doing research for the Indiana State Museum for an exhibition that they're putting together. And my research was really focusing on snacking. And I was looking at the connection between snacking and obesity. And since obesity is a relatively new phenomenon, I started to wonder, is snacking also new? So I began to look in the in the library for books, and no one had written a book about the history of snacking. So that's the initial book I set out to write, was a book on the history of snacking.
And it went from there.
And it did, because as I began to do research on the history of snacking, I realized you really can't tell the story of snacking in America without telling the story of the meal, because if you think about it, they're really two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, I really agree with you on that. And we'll give our listeners a chance to join in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. Have you thought much about why we eat the way we do? Do you see interesting cultural influences on what we eat and how we eat and when we eat it? Maybe you have some favorite foods for a particular meal. Abby might have an idea of why there's that connection. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. The first chapter of your book, right off the bat, is why colonial meals were so messy. And from the way you describe them, that's putting it mildly.
Well, it was messy in two ways. You know, the word mess is an old-fashioned kind of word for food. And yeah. It often food was jumbled, and so it just also happened to be a little bit messy. It wasn't sort of ordered and fancy and fine. But it was also messy because people were not, in the very early years of European settlement in North America, people weren't really, you know, using utensils very much. They might just have a knife, and that they used to cut the meat or the food that they were eating. And then they might use it to spear the food and, you know, transport it to their mouths. That was before the fork appeared in the 1700s. But they also used their hands, and they used bread, and they shared trenchers, and they shared drinking vessels, which often had two or three handles on them. And they tended to, not celebrate the meal as a place where you put on your best manners. That came later. But, you know, for right through, you know, the 1700s, people were not coming together to socialize at a meal so much as to refuel themselves.
Yeah. Did that compare with the Native Americans, the way they came in contact with?
Well, it's interesting because the Native Americans tended to graze, and the Europeans just said that they don't have any fixed meals at all. You know, that was their observation. And for them, this was evidence that they were, in fact, uncivilized. Well, the Native Americans did have a little bit of pattern in their eating, but it was much more relaxed and spontaneous. And of course, they ate, you know, a lot when, you know, they had a great hunt, and then they fasted for times in the winter when food was scarce. And so their foodways were much more regional. The colonists were very proud of having regular meals, but I would say that their meals were actually more rustic than they, you know, would have liked for us to think of them as.
They did give up on the British conventions, did they not, a bit, the colonists?
Well, if you're talking about the kinds of foods they ate, they had to make certain sacrifices because, you know, there weren't apples at first, and there, you know, there wasn't the wheat that they planted didn't take. And so they had to rely on New World staples that the Native Americans were eating, like corn. And they felt pretty ambivalent about it. That was going native. And they saw themselves as Englishmen, and to eat corn was to eat what they had fed their hogs in England. But eventually, corn became something that they celebrated and that they used to differentiate themselves from England, you know, during the era of the American Revolution.
Yeah, so that is, the American Revolution itself affected how our forefathers ate.
Absolutely, yep.
Yeah. So if we're coffee drinkers, that likely goes back to that point in history, does it not?
Actually, the revolution did have some impact on our coffee habits because, you know, we were drinking a lot of tea before then. And I should back up and say one of the fascinating things about the history of coffee and tea as well as chocolate was that they all come to North America in the very late 1600s as mostly medicinals, and you would buy them at your apothecary. Chocolate was not eaten in bar form. It was, you know, it was taken in a cup as a liquid, but it was very, very thick. Anyways, tea eventually, of course, became a tool of protest during the Revolution against the Stamp Act. And so drinking coffee suddenly became a very patriotic alternative.
John in Richland Center has called in. Let's go there. John, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My father was a sailor from the Navy, and he used to give me smoked chums on my birthday. It's a smoked fish.
Chum.
It's a birthday present.
Wow. Smoked chum.
I haven't heard of it.
No, I haven't either. That's a chub I've heard of, smoked chubs. And I've eaten smoked chubs, but never smoked chum. Thanks, John, for calling. Appreciate it. You say in the book that all of the historical and cultural factors that have kind of shaped how and what we eat, of all of those, business is probably at the top of the list. And it seems the largest business impact was the Industrial Revolution. What are the ways in which that period changed the way we eat in the U.S.?
Well, the Industrial Revolution really upended people's schedules and their lives because people were leaving the country for cities. They were taking up factory work instead of farm work. And they were suddenly sort of on the factory schedule, but they were also working farther from home, and they couldn't go back home in the middle of the day to have their midday dinner, which is what they were used to. Dinner had traditionally been a midday meal, the main meal, a hot meal in the middle of the day. And so dinner shifts to the evening to accommodate new working schedules. But when it shifts to the evening, it also changes in nature. It becomes a special meal because the evening is now a special time because people are going in different directions during the day. And suddenly, you know, the evening is their time for reconvening as a family. And so when the evening becomes special, dinner becomes special as well. But, you know, that's also, you know, the story of the Industrial Revolution is also the story of lunch because, you know, lunch, something had to fill in that vacuum that was left in the middle of the day when dinner shifted to the evening. And lunch, which, you know, is a word that once was used interchangeably to mean a small meal or a snack, became the standard, and it was not a very important meal. It didn't have to be, you know, hot. It didn't have to be fancy. It could be very spontaneous, and you could eat it alone. There was no pressure to eat it with other people. you know, it just, it didn't have to do the cultural work that, that dinner was now doing. And so lunch is really shaped by working patterns, and so too is breakfast.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
I was saying, as you were talking, I was thinking back to my, I grew up on a farm,
mm-hmm.
and it was breakfast, dinner, and supper.
Yes.
And dinner, the midday meal, I really was a large meal I think farm families pretty much in the area where I grew up in,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Well, I think that these changes that I'm talking about, they really are urban changes in the beginning, and then they sort of spread out. But you see that people still follow them to a certain extent today. And none of those changes happened overnight, you know.
Yes.
There was confusion for a time between, you know, when dinner shifts to the evening. Do you have two dinners, one in the middle of the day and one in the evening? You know, what do you call, you know, the new meal in the middle of the day? What do you call, you know, dinner in the evening? If, you know, supper is what you used to eat in the evening, do you call it supper even though it's really a big meal now? So, yeah.
And the ways that women and men and whites and African Americans were viewed and treated were clear in the lunch arrangements as well.
Absolutely. It was very interesting. So, you know, at first, when people, you know, went to do their work in factories and at desks in the cities, they just would bring their food with them. And of course, many people continued and do still today continue to do that. But a lot of the conditions were very unsanitary, especially if you think about metal factories. People were literally eating the meals that they brought with them at their workshop desks. And sometimes they even reported that they didn't even wash their hands because they had, you know, it would take such an effort to wash their hands, that would take up a third of their lunch break. And so there was a problem, and government became involved, reform happened, and lunchrooms started popping up. And eventually, at first, they were just rooms, you know, somewhere else where you could go. Eventually, they started serving hot drinks, coffee, et cetera. And then...
went from there. You know, I want to talk about that some more. We need to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, Abigail. Abigail Carroll, our guest, author of Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. There are so many things that we do every day without thinking about how or why we do them the way we do. And I think how we think about meals and what we eat is one of the most fascinating. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Abigail Carroll is an author and food historian who has taught in the gastronomy program at Boston University. She's published articles in many publications, including the New York Times, PhD in American Studies from Boston University. And her book we're talking about is Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. Fascinating book. And she joins us today from the studios of the University of New Hampshire. And Abby, thanks again for spending time with us.
Thanks again for having me.
It's really great. We were talking about lunches before the break, and you know, what and where people ate lunch was kind of a way to determine their social status, was it not?
That's right. You know, if you were a professional in an urban area, you might be eating at a fine dining club. And these were divided by trade. So if you worked in the transportation industry, you might be a member of, you know, a transportation club. And if you were a factory worker, like I was explaining earlier, you would just perhaps bring your lunch with you. It'd be cold. It might be leftover pie. It might be some bread and cheese or some bread and meat. You'd carry it in a tin pail, and you would eat it at the desk at which you were, you know, manufacturing hats or working with metals, and it was very unsanitary. Fortunately, reforms did come into play that established lunchrooms so that people had somewhere else to go to bring their lunch, and they weren't eating it in the more dangerous settings where dangerous substances were. And then for women, there was also eventually women's lunch clubs as well, which were not as prestigious as men's lunch clubs. Most of the women's lunch clubs actually started out as charities. It was for those, you know, smaller a number of women who were working who perhaps, you know, wouldn't feel comfortable in the lunchroom at a factory because it was mostly men. And so they might go down the street to a women's lunch club.
Hmm. And there was also a big change in, we switched to dinner for a minute, with when prepackaged food became more common and when homes started having TV sets in them.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so we see the emergence of processed food and, you know, it's interesting with the, especially in snack food, and one of the ways in which processed food begins to colonize dinner, which is really the most unprocessed of the meals traditionally, is by making snack food into an ingredient. So pretzels become, you know, an ingredient in a pretzel pie crust, or potato chips become a garnish for, you know, casseroles.
Yeah.
And with Thanksgiving coming up, you know, I think of green bean casserole, which is an invention, by the way, of the Campbell's Soup Company in 1955. And, you know, French's fried onions had been around for about 20 years, but they were never terribly popular until that recipe came out. And suddenly, you know, you have a meal where you don't have to do so much cooking. It's more a matter of opening up cans and assembling foods.
You know, I still like that dish, though. You only have it when, you know, it's once a year kind of thing. And so, usually at Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. Well, and, you know, I'm thinking of that. I was, there's a spot you talk about a little bit about Norman Rockwell's painting and how that sort of characterized what we were doing with our dinners.
Yeah, well, in the 19th century, so we're going back a little bit before Norman Rockwell, the ideal American dinner was a French-inspired 3 or 4-course meal. You know, you would have soup or oysters to start, and you would have your entree followed by a green salad and a fancy dessert. And that was the ideal. And Thanksgiving and the sort of ideal dinner of the 20th century changes and it simplifies because we, you know, we don't have servants in the middle class as, you know, servants are no longer standard. They're no longer affordable. And of course you have a lot of need for thrift in the early 20th century. You have the Depression and 2 world wars and dinner necessarily simplifies, but people continue to celebrate abundance. And so Thanksgiving is that more ordinary meal, but a real celebration of abundance. It's kind of a fulfillment of the chicken in every pot, you know, campaign promise of Herbert Hoover. And the Norman Rockwell picture really embodies that, not just a celebration of abundance, but a patriotic celebration of abundance. And that picture was illustrated in 1943, so it's wartime. And so it's a celebration not just of a family eating a meal, but of celebrating, you know, what's being fought for.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed, especially enjoyed your writings about breakfast, because breakfast is so fascinating because of what we think of as breakfast food. Very different from what you might find in other parts of the world, and certainly different from what was common a couple of centuries ago. And the stories you tell about Sylvester Graham and Will Kellogg and Post, I've forgotten his first name now.
Yep, Charles Post.
Charles Post.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What a fascinating bunch.
Yeah, there's quite a story there. You know, it's the whole idea of breakfast food, of eating certain foods that you primarily just eat at breakfast is a very new phenomenon. In the colonial era, breakfast was leftovers, you know, or maybe some cornmeal mush. And it wasn't a special kind of food. And when people were growing in terms of prosperity in the 1700s and the early 1800s, you know, they were eating a lot of meat then for breakfast. And breakfast looked like a miniature dinner. In fact, it wasn't even so miniature. It was really just another dinner. And a lot of Europeans traveling in the United States actually said, you know, I can't tell the difference between breakfast and dinner, except there's wine at one and not at the other. But with the Industrial Revolution and people leaving the agrarian lifestyle and moving to cities and embracing a somewhat more sedentary lifestyle, they really couldn't keep up those farm breakfasts without getting quite a bit of indigestion. And people were complaining of quote-unquote dyspepsia in the 19th century.
Yeah, what was that?
Well, it was basically indigestion. But, of course, the list of possible symptoms went on and on and on and is quite entertaining to read. But people went to sanitariums to find relief. It was kind of like a health spa. And, you know, it was William Kellogg, who ran a sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan. And actually, before him, James Caleb Jackson. And they embraced the idea of whole wheat, which was Sylvester Graham's contribution to the story, whole unbolted wheat as a kind of panacea. And they were critical of meat, and they were trying to find as many possible ways as they could to basically get people to eat whole wheat. And so they experimented and came up with breakfast cereal.
Yeah, it's an absolutely amazing story. And, of course, they wound up making quite a little bit of money.
Yes, they did. It was very profitable.
and of course, Sylvester Graham was the Graham cracker.
Yes,
guy.
Although he would probably roll over in his grave if he knew what was in a Graham cracker today.
I bet he would. Our guest today, Abigail Carroll, and she is the author of Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. You may have a question for her. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And one of our caller earlier who talked about getting smoked chums for a birthday present. We've had several people comment, and I guess chums are a type of Pacific salmon. So smoked chums are really smoked salmon. This is a total aside from what we were talking about, but I wanted to bring it up. So the development of breakfast cereals was linked closely to the movement to cleanse the American diet, but it was also... And I teach journalism classes and science communication classes. So this intrigued me. It's very closely tied to the new field of marketing and advertising.
That's right. And it was really Post who was the entrepreneur who revolutionized advertising. You know, breakfast cereal was also one of the first commercialized foods. That is, that it was sold in a package. We can, you know, actually link that back to Quaker Oats, and snack foods were also, you know, sold in packages, and that provided a whole new opportunity to market a product in a different way, because you had, you know, the surface area, and you could, you know, brand it with a name, and you could also sell it on grocery store or on sort of on the shelf instead of out of a barrel. And a lot of people were buying foods in bulk out of barrels. That was standard. But you never knew if what you were buying was fresh and or what it had been exposed to. And so a lot of the early advertising for a breakfast cereal is promising the consumer that it's going to taste just as fresh as, you know, when it left the factory, and that no hands will have touched it in between.
And they the Quaker on Quaker Oats wound up I was trying to remember exactly how that they bought the company, and it was a Quaker company or something, and they already had a Quaker on the box
There was a trademark that existed, and they bought it, but they used it, you know, in novel ways in terms of advertising, and it's actually a very significant symbol, because you have the Quaker, and he's holding a scroll, and it says pure. And, you know, he looks a little bit like Benjamin Franklin. And so in the early 20th century, when people are you know, there's a lot of adulteration of food. And, you know, the laws haven't been passed yet to protect food from adulteration. And so you start to see this theme of purity. You know, milk is being, you know, marketed as pure in bottles because, you know, if you're getting it ladled out of a bucket, it's not going to be as pure. But in a bottle, it can be more pure. And so anything sold in a package suddenly has this new qualification. You know, it's more pure. And so the Quaker is reminding us that, you know, the Quaker oats in the box are pure.
Oh, man. You talk about how, and we did visit a little bit about snacking, but you talk about how snacking has really been viewed over the centuries, as I also found pretty interesting. The beginnings of American history, there were no taboos about snacking because, mm-hmm. you know, there were people were doing manual labor. You ate what you needed to pretty much when to get mm-hmm. the work done.
Yeah. Yeah, I think no one really, you know, looked, you know, blinked an eye if you were you know, grabbing food in between meals. And there wasn't such thing really as snack foods in the early days because people just grabbed, you know, a slice of pie or leftovers, or bread was a typical snack, bread with butter or cheese. And of course beer, you know, people were drinking a lot of beer with a little bit of a lower alcohol content than today, but that was how they hydrated themselves in a time when there wasn't always pure water, but it also supplied calories. So anyways, that was a kind of snack as well. But in the Victorian era, when we have the emergence of the modern meal and dinner shifts to the evening and becomes that family ritual, suddenly there's something sacred about the meal, and it has to be protected. And the snack is seen as an offense to that family ritual. And it's also seen as lower class because it's really at lower class venues of entertainment like vaudeville theaters and sports arenas and fairs that that people are snacking. And that's when snack foods like peanuts and popcorn are becoming popular. And, you know, if you went to the vaudeville theater, the cheap upper seats of the balcony were called the peanut gallery because there were so many peanut jackets on the floor. It practically carpeted the floor. Yeah. And peddlers were selling, you know, snack foods. And that, you know, it was a street food. And peddlers often came from foreign countries, and they didn't speak good English, and they were dirt poor. And they, you know, a lot of Americans didn't trust their standards of hygiene. And so there was that suspicion as well about snack food. So snack food had a lot against it. There was a lot of stigma that it carried during the Victorian era. And it was really through commercialization and the packaging of snack foods that snack foods were reinvented. It was also something that people associated with drinking. You know, you went to the saloon and you had your pretzels to put on an edge on your thirst. yeah.
And hot dogs, there's a food that started as a snack food.
Yeah.
Became a mealtime food as well eventually.
Yeah, it's really interesting because there's this blurriness between what's a meal and what's a snack. And, you know, when lunch emerges, people are eating sandwiches for the meal, but sandwiches are thought of as a snack as well, because even though they might stand in for the meal and do the work of a meal, you know, they're not something you use utensils for. You don't sit down, you don't heat it, you don't cook it. It's not typical meal food in the sense of dinner food. And so hot dogs fit into that category. Hot dogs are also eaten at baseball games, you know, where people are, you know, throwing off all of the mealtime conventions that they would normally be embracing. But then, of course, hot dogs, you know, do come to stand in for a meal, and they become very iconic of American food. When foreigners come to the United States, they have to have their hot dog, and diplomats are seen, you know, they're having their picture taken eating a hot dog. That's very important.
Well, and you know, why is the hot dog associated with baseball?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, of course, there's all sorts of mythology about how the hot dog was invented, and that mythology, you know, traces it to the ballpark. And there's two particular stories, one from St. Louis and one from New York. You know, the idea that in New York it was a cold day and, you know, people were used to eating sandwiches in the ballpark, but they needed something hot. And, you know, concession workers were sent out to get sausages in buns, and they stuck them to together. You know, there's mm-hmm. these stories. And I think that that's just part of the mythology of baseball, that hot dogs, you know, are part, or, you know, that their origins are there. But actually people, you know, this was related to, you know, German immigrants and sausages and buns. People were eating sausages and buns actually before some of these stories, you know, about the baseball park supposedly took place. So.
Joe in Prairie du Chien up next. Joe, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm curious, is this family structure one of the underlying factors in our diets and how we eat? In the Victorian era, as you mentioned, it was a highly structured system, and they would sit down and eat. As we get, you know, in our times, kids are told to turn the cell phone off so they can, you know, finish their meal. Mm-hmm. And the other, and I'm wondering what the correlation there might be. Also, it's interesting you mentioned that originally packaged food was considered the purer stuff. I find that quite interesting.
That's
we transition into organic and, you know, homegrown and farmed, local farms. So thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I think it's a great point that you make that, you know, snack food was thought of as pure, but, you know, by the 1970s, it was being called junk food. So, you know, it wasn't that it was thought of as a health food, but just that it was more reliable. And I think family structure has a lot to do with meals. In some ways, meals could be thought of as scaffolding for family structure, because in the Victorian era, it was the meal that brought the family together. And so, you know, the family needed a way of coming together, and the meal was the perfect solution for that. And I think that we've seen that really brought into question, you know, today as the family meal declines, and it has been in decline since the 1950s. And as we have all sorts of distractions, we have a lot of screens that are distracting us, not to mention schedules and work. And those demands really put a lot of pressure on the family meal. And I think, you know, moving into the future, that's something that we want to be thinking about as a society. And that is, how can we use, you know, the meal, you know, to build family and to build relationship. The meal has for a long time been about relationship, but there's definitely a question as to whether, to what extent that continues and will continue.
Yeah, which is kind of sad from my old-fashioned view here. I would like, and frankly, in our own family, breakfast is not, we do not eat breakfast together as an entire family unit because of work circumstances. Mm-hmm. But we do try to always have dinner together.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether or not that's going to hold is another question. A caller who couldn't stay on, I wanted to share this. She said, you're talking about different cultures with different meals. She said, I read this quote that really stuck with me. It applies to our discussion now. It is, here's the quote, pleasure is not a frivolous process. It is necessary for the survival of the species. Food tastes great because we need it to survive.
Wow. So you're bringing taste into the equation. How revolutionary. I think this is wonderful. And that's what really surprised me when I went and did the research for this book, was how little taste seemed to weigh in the, you know, shaping of the meal. I do think that it's something to think about. I think it's important. But even those things that we think of as very tasty, you know, dessert foods and sweet foods, we're often, you know, not even celebrated for the taste aspect. You know, in the turn of the century, women's luncheons, all of these fancy, you know, molded sort of gelatin salads, these dainty things were being served. But it was not about taste. It was all about control. And, of course, you couldn't be seen to enjoy something too much. And that came right out of the Victorian era. It was just, you know, there's a lot of taboo, not only about snacking in the Victorian era, but about sweetness. And I think it was seen as self-indulgent. And that's really where we have this sort of, I guess, moral element that comes in, you know, where questions of snacking and questions of sweetness and pleasure become, you know, they start to fall on a good and bad scale. Yeah.
Boy, I have so many more questions for you here, but we're out of time, unfortunately. This is, and I really enjoyed reading about the current trends and cultural factors that might shape what we're going to be eating in the next century. Abigail, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again for having me.
Yeah, very much appreciated. Abigail Carroll is author of Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. Go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We've got links to both authors and their books from today. And I think you're really going to enjoy, frankly, both of these books. They're wonderful books. Abigail Carroll. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.